I know I feel better overall when I get outside and I get active. But when I don't have the right gear, especially when the weather is unpredictable this spring, it's harder to live that life that I really want. And that's why I'm sort of obsessed now with my Vessi shoes. I have two pairs, and I'm literally wearing at least one of them every day because Vessis are so comfortable, they're easy to get on and off when I'm on the go, and they are super stylish. I love how they look. Plus, get this, they're also 100% waterproof. And I really turn to my Stormburst high tops when I'm ready for a bit more adventuring out and about. They are so versatile, though. I can wear them for everyday errands and getting things done, or taking them into the elements, from beach days to walking around the city to a rainy day hike. Elevate your spring wardrobe with Vessi's Stormburst shoes. Discover more at vessi.com/newsworthy. Get your pair today to get an automatic 15% off your first purchase at checkout and be ready to step out in style, rain or shine. Trust me, you will not regret this. Go to vessi.com/newsworthy to get your new favorite shoes with an automatic 15% off your first purchase at checkout.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Today is Saturday, March 16th. Abortion is front and center this election year, and for good reason. We've seen a lot changing and being challenged on both the state and federal levels since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade back in the summer of 2022. Recently, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled embryos are children, threatening IVF services in the state. And that prompted state lawmakers to protect those services, but still left many questions unanswered. Separately, later this month, the U.S. Supreme Court is set to hear arguments about the so-called abortion pill. And after that, the High Court will consider another case related to abortions in life or death situations. Today, we're talking about the legal arguments specific to these issues and the potential implications nationwide. Our guest today, Mary Ziegler, is a legal historian and professor of law. She's known as a leading authority on the legal history of the abortion debate in the United States. She's a professor at the UC Davis School of Law and the author of several books. Her most recent book is called Roe, the History of a National Obsession, and she's currently writing her new book about the fetal personhood debate. She's here to explain some of these issues top of mind right now and offer some historical perspective, too. Welcome, welcome to the Newsworthy Special Edition Saturday, when we sit down with a different expert or celebrity every Saturday to talk about something in the news. Don't forget to tune in every Monday through Friday for our regular episodes, where we provide all the day's news in 10 minutes. I'm Erica Mandy. It's now time for today's Special Edition Saturday. Mary Ziegler, thank you so much for joining us here on the Newsworthy.
Thanks for having me.
So obviously in June of 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade with the Dobbs decision, essentially leaving it up to states to decide abortion access. So first, just big picture, how would you describe the impact of that decision and, you know, the overall legal status of abortion in the U.S. right now?
Very chaotic, I guess, would be the description. The Supreme Court suggested in the Dobbs ruling that there has been a lot of chaos and conflict around abortion and that Roe was part of the problem. And I think the inference was that maybe things would simmer down once Roe was gone. And we've seen the opposite. We've seen a lot of conflicts about state laws. We've seen conflicts between states. We've seen fights in the federal courts. So if anything, kind of multiplying fields of battle. And we've seen other things like miscarriage treatment and IVF swept in as well.
Yeah, and let's talk about each of those things a little bit more. Obviously, one of the issues now is this fetal personhood. It's central to a lot of the debates. We saw Alabama's Supreme Court define an embryo as a child, which then led to some of the issues that you were mentioning, the confusion with IVF. Of course, state lawmakers then went back to try to protect IVF, but let's help people understand this particular issue a little bit more. Can you explain what fetal personhood is from a legal perspective?
The anti-abortion movement really since the 1960s has been fighting for this idea of personhood. And the basic premise is that the word person in various laws, but particularly in the U.S. Constitution, applies from the moment of fertilization. So that would mean that, for example, rights to due process and equal protection of law apply to a fetus or embryo as much as to anyone else.
What was your reaction to that initial Alabama ruling?
I mean, I wasn't surprised that we would see it somewhere. I think this felt very much kind of like an opening salvo. I think that's what anti-abortion activists understood it to be as well. And I think that's still true, even after Alabama legislators have passed a law to try to address the issue. I don't think we've seen the last of the issue in Alabama or really anywhere else.
So you don't think that kind of newer law trying to protect IVF specifically clarifies things enough, or explain more what you think it does and does not do?
The reason it leaves some unanswered questions is because it doesn't address this question of whether embryos are in fact persons. So you could imagine anti-abortion groups saying, well, you know, the state statute protects IVF, but the state statute violates the state constitution because it's violating the rights of these persons. The legislature is saying they're persons. The state Supreme Court is saying they're persons. So denying this wrongful death remedy or even these criminal protections against IVF providers is unconstitutional under state law. And it's I think, far from a sure thing that the state court wouldn't buy that argument, given what it said in the original ruling.
Where else does this come up outside of IVF?
I mean, most commonly with abortion, that's been the impetus for a fetal personhood movement in the first place. Of course, what constitutes an abortion is contested. So that means that there's implications for common contraceptives like IUDs, the birth control pill, and the like, because some people opposed to abortion define those drugs as abortifacients rather than contraceptives. So there are lots of unanswered questions as well, because of course, if fetuses or embryos are persons, you know, what does that mean for other areas of the law, right? What does it mean for tax deductions? What does it mean for census counts? What does it mean for the drawing of district lines for the purposes of elections? What does it mean for intestacy law and inheritance? Like, there's a lot of things we wouldn't know if a court went all the way to recognizing fetuses or embryos as persons for all purposes.
Do you expect all of this to eventually come up?
I do. I mean, I think, the anti-abortion movement's fight really from the beginning has been for fetal personhood. And I think that the Alabama experience won't discourage personhood proponents at all. I think they'll see state courts as potential places they can win.
The U.S. Supreme Court will soon begin hearing arguments over access to the pill called mifepristone, an FDA-approved drug that is commonly used in medically induced abortions. It can also be used for miscarriages. Can you just give us an overview of the legal arguments on both sides of this issue, and why is this coming up now?
This case was brought by a group called the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, which is a group of anti-abortion doctors. The lawyers in the case are a group called the Alliance Defending Freedom. And these groups are arguing that the pill mifepristone, which was approved in 2000, was never properly approved. The FDA didn't have the authority to do so in 2000, and that the FDA, again, didn't have the authority to lift restrictions on access to mifepristone in 2016 and again in 2021. The case has been working its way through the lower courts, and the U.S. Supreme Court has let the status quo regarding mifepristone stay in place as the litigation continues, which would suggest that maybe the justices have some problems with the conservative plaintiff's case. It's not clear the plaintiffs have standing to be in court, really, that they have enough direct impact on them to even be the ones raising this issue. It's not clear they raised any of these claims in a timely manner. I mean, we're talking about things in some instances that happened nearly, 25 years ago. Conversely, there are lots of explosive possibilities if the court does side with the plaintiffs, right? They could require people accessing these pills in blue as well as red states to make multiple in-person visits to physicians and make the pills inaccessible up to the 10th week of pregnancy, which is the current standard of care. They could set a precedent, of course, that people who don't like a drug could come around years later when they have very little connection to what's happening and argue that the FDA misread the evidence. That, of course, could have implications for other drugs that people have questions about or that are politicized, like vaccines. And there's a final possibility involving this law called the Comstock Act, which is a 19th century obscenity law. And the plaintiffs in this case argue the FDA didn't have the authority to allow telehealth abortion because the Comstock Act actually makes it a crime to mail anything having to do with abortion. So, of course, if the Supreme Court goes down that road, the Comstock Act would be sort of a Pandora's box. In other words, it would have implications beyond mifepristone.
And obviously beyond the states, potentially beyond the states that have restricted access to abortion.
Absolutely. Any win for the plaintiffs in this case would have implications for people in states that have actually voted to protect abortion.
Still ahead, our guest explains the history of how abortion became so entrenched in politics. Mary Ziegler will also explain what's at stake in the other upcoming Supreme Court case related to abortion and more. But first, a quick break for our sponsors. I recently saw someone online talking about why they fired their doctor, or in other words, stopped being a patient, because they didn't feel heard or cared about. And I can relate. I've pretty much done that before. And I think it's a good thing to do, honestly, if it's not a good fit with your doctor. Because when it comes to our health and the doctor we choose to trust, there are no compromises. We deserve to have a doctor we feel comfortable with, who listens, and who prioritizes our health. And if you need help finding that type of doctor, check out ZocDoc. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. And these docs all have verified reviews from real patients. Plus, you can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, live near you, and treat the type of condition you need to discuss. It's where I go whenever I'm searching for a new doctor, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/newsworthy and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/newsworthy. ZocDoc.com/newsworthy. And thanks to AG1. So I have noticed I need more nutrient support than I used to now that I have a toddler, which means my sleep sometimes suffers, and since he recently started preschool, my immune system is challenged more often these days. Plus, I'm just busier and on the go more often. So I'm really glad to know that AG1 is covering my nutritional basis with high-quality ingredients like pre- and probiotics, adaptogens, antioxidants, and whole food-sourced nutrients. I know when I drink it daily, I'm going to feel that extra boost. And I have. I've felt the difference in my daily life. AG1 supports my energy, my focus, and my immune system. And it really is so simple. One scoop of AG1, or I grab a travel pack, mixed with water in the bottle they send, shake it up, and I'm all set. If there's one product I had to recommend to elevate your health, it's AG1. And that's why I partnered with them for so long. So if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. And they have a great deal for our listeners. Try AG1 and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase exclusively at drinkag1.com/newsworthy. That's drinkag1.com/newsworthy. Check it out. Now back to our conversation. And then also during this term, the Supreme Court will consider whether the federal government can require physicians to provide emergency abortions if the mother's life is at risk. Can you explain the two sides of that case and how we got here?
Sure. So this case really began when the Biden administration began interpreting this federal law called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act. And at its most basic, this law was passed in the 80s because hospitals were turning away patients with emergencies because they didn't have the ability to pay. And the Biden administration put out guidance saying, if you are a hospital that accepts any form of Medicare funding, we interpret this law to mean that if a patient is having a medical emergency, and if that emergency, the standard would be to give that patient abortion to address the emergency, and the state fails to do that, it's violated the statute. The idea, too, was that that would override state laws to the contrary. So in other words, if the state law's exception in a state with a ban didn't permit that abortion, the Biden administration was saying, well, the federal law trumps. And if you ignore this guidance, there'll be powerful federal consequences under this statute. So the Biden administration then went after Idaho for what it said was the violation of the law. Then Texas fired back in its own lawsuit saying we have no obligation to do anything under this statute. And now that the case has reached the Supreme Court, we're seeing conservatives, states, as well as friends of the court briefs saying essentially, not only is there no obligation to intervene to help patients who have a medical emergency, there's limits on the state's ability to do that because the statute refers to an unborn child as a patient. So essentially they're saying that there are limits on what you can do because the unborn child as a patient has rights too. So that could be pretty explosive if you stop to think about it, right? If the Supreme Court agrees with Idaho, which seems likely because again, in the court, so far the court has allowed Idaho's law to stay in effect, then that would mean both that people with life-threatening medical emergencies would not be allowed to access abortion, and potentially too that the court would say there are scenarios where in other states, people are disallowed from having abortions in medical emergencies because of these rights of the unborn patient. So there's a lot on the line in this case as well.
Historically speaking, have we seen so many things related to abortion on the line at one time before?
No, this is really unusual. I mean, I remember when you think back to the kind of pre-Dobbs years, and it was very, you know, uncommon for the court to even have an abortion case every year or two. So often it would be 6-7 years in between major abortion cases. So to have two in a term is a pretty big deal. And then, of course, it's especially striking given that the Supreme Court had sort of promised implicitly that the federal courts were out of the business, right? That this was going to be returning the question to the people and their elected representatives, when we've seen, of course, the federal courts at least as involved or maybe more involved than they ever were.
And I think you've said that abortion in general has not always been so divisive and partisan. Is that true? And how did we get here?
Abortion definitely wasn't always a partisan issue, though. So if you go back to before Roe or even the immediate aftermath of Roe, you would have prominent politicians and lots of voters in both parties who either opposed or supported abortion. And it wasn't really until the 1980s when Ronald Reagan saw abortion as a way to peel away socially conservative Catholic and Protestant voters who would historically have been Democrats for, you know, reasons of economic self-interest, that there was sort of a partisan alignment that emerged. And once there was that partisan alignment, it kind of created a self-reinforcing cycle of polarization. I think it's fair to say abortion is divisive in some ways, right? But if you look at popular opinion on abortion, it's pretty stable. Most Americans don't want abortion to be illegal throughout pregnancy. We've had fairly stable majorities, although narrower than in Europe, for abortion being legal for a long time. What's been unstable or what's been really divisive has been that there are social movements on either side of this issue that are very passionate and effective in ways that we don't see in other countries.
Where do you see the abortion debate headed next in America?
We've seen abortion rights succeeding at the polls. So far, we've had a number of ballot initiatives in both 2022 and 2023 where abortion rights have prevailed. So I think on the kind of popular politics side, when voters are given a chance to weigh in directly about what abortion law should look like, they tend to be very supportive of at least decriminalizing it. Then there's the tougher question of, well, what happens? You know, is that actually what our policy is going to be? There, I think a lot will depend on how effectively anti-abortion groups can use either the federal courts or the federal court and the executive branch if Donald Trump is reelected to kind of go around what voters would prefer when left to their own devices about this question.
Any final thought or takeaway for our listeners?
I think it's easy to feel that if you live in a state that has protections for abortion rights, or a state that's going to have a ballot initiative, or a state like Ohio or Michigan that recently voted for a ballot initiative, that the 2024 election isn't going to affect you. This is probably going to be one of the most consequential elections when it comes to these issues that we've seen in our lifetimes, right? Because there's a lot that a president could do, particularly a Republican president, without Congress to make abortion inaccessible or even illegal in blue states. So I think that's kind of a parting thought, that if this is an issue that matters to you in one way or another, it's very much on the ballot.
Well, thank you so much to Mary Ziegler for sharing her legal expertise. We'll, of course, keep you updated as these abortion debates play out across the country in our regular weekday episodes, alongside all the other news you need to know for the day. We bring you a wide variety of stories every Monday through Friday in our signature 10-minute news roundups to help keep you in the know. So we'll be back on Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.